Coming to you from the greatest city in the world, it's the season finale of Ventriloquism Weekly. Wow. And I mean wow. Matt Bailey here, and I just got off the phone with John Max, writer for all 22 years of Jay Leno's Tonight Show. And he's the author of the new book, Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. And during our talk, we really get into it about comedy late night and comedy on late night. But I promise you, it is valuable for all. We really get into what's a joke, what's a good joke, how do you find a joke, how do you write a joke, how do you pick a joke. It's all there. It is all there. Now, Max has a resume unlike any other. He's written jokes for almost every celebrity you can imagine. Steve Martin, Billy Crystal, and our very own Terry Fader are just some of the names mentioned in our chat. He's also written for numerous award shows, the Academy Awards, Golden Globes, Emmys, you name it, he's written for it. Yet, he began his career as a lawyer in political consulting. Now, I know there's a joke in there somewhere, but I bet he can find about 100 jokes. Here now, our interview with 7-time Emmy Award-nominated writer, John Max. John Max, welcome to Ventriloquism Weekly. How are you today, sir?
Doing great, Mac. Doing great.
Oh, this is an honor to have you. 7-time Emmy Award nominee, Tonight Show writer, storied career that you chronicle in your new book, Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. And I just want to ask right off the bat, why'd you decide to write the book?
You know, it felt like time in this sense. I'd been at the Tonight Show for 22 years. I had a lot of stories, and kind of, you know, it made me think, looking back, what impact has Jay and the Tonight Show had, you know, which led to what impact have all these late night shows had. And, you know, I knew that there was going to be a lot of other changes coming at late night over the next year or so, which obviously are coming right now. Mm-hmm. So the idea was, you know, the timing was right. It was a good way to get some stories.
That's fantastic. Now, let's talk about your beginnings in writing. You began as the total antithesis of a writer. You'd always been a writer, but you actually went to law school and were, you talk about this in the book, you did some stuff in politics before jumping in and being a writer full time.
Yeah, I went to law school with the full intent of never practicing law. you know, which is a good thing, although my mother still says, you know, it's something to fall back on.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happens, I was, while I was in law school, I was running a political campaign. I just continued to do that, won my first two, lost my next 23, wasn't in too great shape, then ended up hitting one, won a governor of Pennsylvania's race, moved to Washington, D.C., did a lot of campaigns across the country, the TV ad, the debate prep, speeches, and then after, you know, 6 years of doing that at a pretty high level, I just got tired of, I was flying 200 nights a year. I had three kids, at least three that I knew of. Could be four. And, you know, so it was, I sent some jokes in to Jay Leno, and he started to use them, and he gave me a call when he was taking over the Tonight Show and said, why don't you come on out for a few weeks? So I came out for the 13 weeks, you know, I had a 13-week deal. I told my partners, I'll be back. And that was 23 years ago.
That's great. That's great. Now, what prompted you? You mentioned this a little bit in the book. Can you talk more about what prompted you to just start sending Jay Leno jokes to use?
Right. It is a great question. I had done a campaign for a U.S. senator named Paul Simon from Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is in Washington, there's a series of speeches where you're supposed to be funny. The alfalfa speech, the gridiron speech, and Paul was doing the gridiron, which is, you know, they have someone from each party make funny remarks in front of reporters who put on sketches and skits. And Paul said, John, you're funny. Why don't you write some jokes? So I did, and they apparently went pretty well. And Frank Mankiewicz, who had put the speech together for Paul, called me and said, you're pretty good at this. And I thought that just might be a nice way of saying I was a really lousy political consultant. But I saw that Jay was buying jokes from freelancers. He was guest hosting for Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. So I figured, you know, I always like to write jokes. Let me try it. So I started sending them in, and he started using them, and that's what led me to where I am.
That's incredible. That's just wonderful. Now, it takes talent, and you certainly are a talented writer. We're going to touch on all the people that you have put jokes together for. And I just want to ask, where do you find the stamina? Because the stamina, that's incredible. We were talking on the phone the other day, 100 jokes a day, even more. You know, 500,000 jokes that you say in the book in the 22 years that you did The Tonight Show. Where does that stamina come from?
Three really greedy children and a wife who's sending me into an early grave. That's of course the first thing. Now, yeah. You know what it is I think that you know different writers write different styles. Mm-hmm. There were writers on the Tonight Show who wrote like 30 jokes a day, and they were all beauties. For me to get to what I wanted, my process was take a topic, start in a joke, and almost just see. It was A that led to B, to led to C, to led to D, and sometimes joke E was the best one.
Right.
You know, but it was, you know, it's stamina is a good word. Discipline might be the other. There's a lot of people out there who want to write and just don't have the discipline to sit down and I call it start typing. Mm-hmm. So every morning, you know, I get up at 6:30, I check the websites, I see what's the news, I read a paper. To get my ideas of what's going on in the world, I get to work, I write down 9 topics for the day, completely arbitrary number, Matt, just to give me a start.
Yeah.
And then I would kind of do association jokes, you know, A connects to B, do those. Then you go to the small stories, excuse me, like, you know, I call them a man in Belgium story.
Yeah.
You know, you find a weird oddball story from some faraway place and you use that as your setup. But sometimes in those, the setup's funnier than the premise, than the actual joke. And do those, and, you know, by the time you're done, you see you've hit 100 jokes, and I just want to point out one thing. I wrote 500,000 jokes. 482,000 are in a landfill somewhere. They got read and thrown out, so let's put it in perspective. Most get unused.
Yeah, but it's still incredible, and it's an incredible ratio because of what has to, the amount of volume every day for Jay's monologue that has to just get kind of whittled down into what the monologue will be. And it was very sort of, I want to say competitive, but that may be too negative. You talk about, you know, really wanting to make sure you get a joke in as often as you can. What were the ingredients of jokes that sort of found their way into Jay's monologue that you did?
You know, I think what happened is, you know, with all comics, you have to hit their voice. And I think that, you know, but, you know, after 22 years, I think I've got Jay's voice in perspective.
Yeah.
Again, in the end, he would always take and mold them. We collectively probably wrote about 1,000 jokes a day.
Mm-hmm.
He would read them. He'd winnow those down to about 100 that he'd be considering. And then he and the head writer, Jack Cohen, would sit down and narrow it down to the 25 or 30 that would make monologue. Of those remaining 70 that had been considered, maybe 10 or 15 might carryovers for the next day, and then you start again. What made it in, you know, obviously he had to think it's funny, but it was, you know, he would always hit, what are the biggest topics in the news? What are people talking about? Jay had a great love of politics and politicians and finding them funny, so anything like that. Celebrities, sports, then you get the small, like I said, the small oddball stories. We always like to do those, you know, what I call the informative joke. You know, a study says that, you know, 90% of babies are conceived in July, you know, or whatever it may be, and then you just work backwards and explain how that happens. Well, sure, the NBA and Congress are in recess then. You know what I mean? So you get your joke off of that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, how much of what went into what Jay liked to do, the politics and topics about things that weren't necessarily political but went to Jay's sensibility, informed what you write? I guess what I'm asking is there something you didn't, that you really wanted to write, but because you knew Jay just wouldn't go for it, you didn't really bother with it when you were looking for your articles?
It would never be on political agenda or anything like that, because with Jay, it was, you know, if there was anything, it was a three-part thing.
Mm-hmm.
One is, what's stupid about this situation? You know, who did or said something stupid? Second is, are they a big enough person? you know, and third, of course, was it funny? But we would never write anything. I mean, Jay would never take tell us an ethnic stereotype or a racial joke or anything like
right.
that. That's not his style of humor. So those would be the only ones that no one would write because it would be just a waste of time. He's not going to do it, and you're just wasting your time. But in terms of politics, no one would go in there and say, well, geez, Dave did three jokes about Bill Clinton yesterday. We better do two about, you know, George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
No, you just write off of what's funny and what's in the news and what's topical, and then you let him, because he's seen the overview, pick and choose what works best.
That's great. And when you write for Jay, obviously you got to tap into that. What's it like writing for other people? Sometimes when guests would come on the show, you talk about in the book, Arnold, when he announced, you wrote some lines, and Marty Short, all these different people that you've wrote for over the years. How do you distinguish?
You know, what happens is, you know, it's always hard to write for somebody who you literally don't know for their voice.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been lucky enough to write for, you know, Billy Crystal and Chris Rock, Steve Martin, Marty Short. And what you do is I would always try to actually talk to them on the phone first. Just spend 5 minutes, see what's going on in their lives.
Yeah.
Literally get their voice. And then you kind of move to the, you know, well, what do you want to talk about when you go do the your act in, you know, the Kravis Center in Palm Beach?
Yeah.
Well, you know, let's talk about Florida a little bit. You know what I mean? And you get that sense. And then you write, you know, a joke that Chris Rock does. The topics may be the same, but the punchlines, the inflection, the point of view are going to be different. And that's just something you have to know. You don't write, when you're a writer, don't write in your voice, write in theirs.
Yeah. And that leads into, because, you know, we have a lot of, this is Ventriloquism Weekly, so we have a lot of entertainers of all sorts that listen in. The thing that, the debate that kind of rages in all entertainment, I think, is the comedy is property. And one thing you talk about in the book that is so interesting to me is that writers in the same building, not communicating with each other, would write the same joke. But a different version of it would show up in the monologue, whoever wrote it the most succinctly or whatever. What are your thoughts?
Jay would take it or Jay could take it and change it, put it in his own words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are your thoughts when somebody says, oh, that joke's mine, I came up with it. Oh, well, no, I came up with it independently. How do you determine the proprietary aspect of a joke?
You know, again, the way we looked at it with Jay was all jokes are his.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, if there's 18 writers and 8 of us are working on the monologue and 5 of us do the same joke about the tanning bomb, if you remember that story, or 5 of us do the same joke about Hillary erasing her emails,
yeah.
You know, it's more of a, you know, again, in the end, since, he, you know, there is, for whatever account that they did at the show, they know whose it actually was. But you're looking for, you know, exact wording. I call it sometimes putting in a writer's DNA.
Yeah.
There might be a particular phrase. I was always big with this just in to open up a joke. Making it seem much more important than it was. But sometimes, if you would say that in, you go, well, yeah, that was probably. But in the end, you know, it was a very non-competitive group because Jay was always such an easygoing guy. He was never one to say, guys, come on, do better, or anything like that. So that made it really easy in terms of that. There was not any, you know, you hear about stories about Saturday Night Live and cutthroat internal politics. Never on with us with Jay.
Can internal politics be a danger to the comedy?
I think so, because I think for two reasons. You know, one reason you can say, well, it sharpens it when you're fighting for the best joke. But what I think happens is that oftentimes the loudest voice in the room wins, and the loudest voice in the room may not be the best writer. The best writer is the one who constructs the best joke or has the best angle. So I think that an inordinate amount of time is spent at some shows, you know, fighting to see who gets what in, and they don't have the best joke. Chris Rock told me recently, he said, you know what we've got? I said, what do you mean? He goes, we've got jokes. So what do you mean? He goes, wherever we go, he was nice enough to use a plural. He goes, you know, we've got jokes. We come in there for any time he does an act. He's got, you know, 50 more jokes prepared, another 8 minutes more prepared than anyone else on the bill. So that he knows that he's got the selection. Second part of what Chris says is, it's easy to write a joke sometimes. Picking jokes is hard. And that's where the true great ones come in. Because a lot of different people are going to have the same joke or the same basic concept, but it's the ones who know how they flow, how they should flow in the order, what's the best one of the three jokes on a particular topic. That's the true genius out there.
So how would Jay, what do you think Jay's thought process was when picking that monologue?
The first part was, again, you know, I think he did it, you know, the first weeding out is, did it make me laugh?
Mm-hmm.
As he read, I mean, again, a lot of comics, they laugh inside. So the first one is, did it make him laugh? The second concept, and again, this is trying to, looking into the room and trying to guess what's going on, as he's going through all those file cards. And I think the second thing is, in addition to, did it make me laugh, is it something unique? Is it a unique take? When you're doing that many jokes and that many shows, sure, you're going to take what I call the easy layups. You're going to take the easy joke. You're going to do, the one that's a little obvious because it has to be,
Mm-hmm.
But it's what's the second and third joke at the top? What's a unique twist? What's something that people didn't think of? With Jay's perspective, it's always, what is stupid about this that we will all agree on is stupid?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that? And then third is, the question is, okay, do we, a big news story breaks. Let's just take, for example, Barack Obama blows off some event to go play golf, and everyone's jumping on it. You're not going to do eight jokes on it. You're going to do two. So what are the best two out of that? What are the ones that, you look at saying one that goes, what is one that is, a joke that fits just within Obama? The second, what can be taken to somewhere else? Again, he had trouble playing golf the other day. He got caught in the sand trap. President Bush said, I call that a rack. You know what I mean? So you're taking it to another level.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you also write for a friend of ours, Terry Fader. And when you write,
great Terry Fader. I am so lucky. I got a call. I had a question about launch into a story. Terry had was looking for a writer a few years ago because he wanted to add some things to his act in Las Vegas. And I had seen him on America's Got Talent. I knew he was at the headliner at the Mirage.
Mm-hmm.
And, I knew he, had just an incredible and unique talent. And I got the call, and they said, would you like to meet Terry? So I flew to Vegas, and we had dinner. And the deal was that he was introducing a new puppet, a new character. And, could we bounce some ideas back and forth? And so I went over his house the next day. And what we did basically is, it wasn't, our writing sessions are different from others. With other people, I just send in jokes a lot of times. With Terry, it's an actual conversation. Where does the character come from? What would he do? What is his role in the show? And it would be what I call conversation and typing.
Mm-hmm.
I have this ability to type without looking at the laptop, which means it's all gibberish a lot of times. But, we would do that, and we actually finished the character, and we just kept going and kind of rewrote the whole show, and I've been with him for 4 years.
That's fantastic. Yeah, there was something at Van Haven, and you were in the video. He came, did a writing workshop, and it was just a thrown-together video that showed your writing session for this alien puppet that Steve Axtell had sent him to do for this writing session. So that was very, very interesting to see. Do you prefer one method over the other, the collaboration sitting on the sofa or the lock myself in the room and let me write 100 jokes?
Everybody's different. I go with, like I said, it's all about the talent. It's all not mine, the stars.
Mm-hmm.
So Terry is a back and forth, let's just talk this out and kind of type it up as we go. Others say, just send me the jokes, I'll pick. Others are, send me the jokes and let's get on the phone and go over them. Others are, send me the jokes, I'll put you my takes, and then you add to that. And, what you just have to do is you just have to make that decision that, you're going to, you kind of just feel it out. I don't really prefer one over the other. The only thing I'm not good at, I'm not good at many things, but one thing I don't like doing is when somebody, you sit in a room and somebody says, well, just pitch a joke. No, I'm more of a let me type it, construct it.
Mm-hmm.
Terry is lucky because it's conversational, as opposed to shine the spotlight on me and I'm the trained monkey throwing out a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather go all, let me go leave the room for 5 minutes and type up 10 jokes.
Yeah, and it's funny because I know a lot of vents, myself included, that I'll get up with the puppet. I'll do something. I'll go, let me write that down. It doesn't work in reverse. You got to throw it out there sometimes too. It's,
yep.
You're exactly right that it is so personal. I want to switch gears again because having somebody who has been in late night, which I have been fascinated with for many, many years, something you touch on in the book is Jay started this thing about doing political jokes and getting his take on the news and getting these people, having these people, what they do, not who they are, but what they do made fun of. And it started all of this sort of political late night parody and satire. And now you say something very poignant, which is that now late night is becoming the source where we get our news. Is there a danger in getting our news from the daily shows, from the Colbert reports, even from a late night monologue at 11:30, where we're getting that biased satire with it?
Here's what I think. I think that you know, people are smart enough that when I say getting the news, let me split it up.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting what the topic is that is in the news a lot. People, you know, 30 years ago, people would say, well, the nightly news is on. We have to go watch and find out what Tom Brokaw's saying. Well, you know, I think two things happen. One, you know, we realize we don't have to have evening news doesn't have to be appointment television. Mm-hmm. Two, we can get it 24/7. And three, as we found out with Brian Williams, maybe our news anchors are not exactly the most truthful people we've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
So you go in the situation, and I think anyone who knows or is watching Jon Stewart, and I think he's fantastic,
yeah,
understand that Jon is giving you his point of view. He's giving you a point of view. But the fact and the premise remains the same. Remember, the premise, the setup, is always factual. It's based on a real story. So you're getting information that a Sarah Palin, you know, was talking about foreign policy with Charles Gibson, mm-hmm, and wasn't completely articulate in explaining why she was qualified to be president.
Yeah.
Now, if you actually believe that she said, I can see Russia from my house, well, and that's what people believe, well, I always say that's the joke. It's not the fact. You know, Tina Fey said, I can see Russia from my house, not Sarah Palin.
Yeah, that's very well put. And another thing about Jay's comedy and comedy in general, late night comedy, is that sometimes, as we found out in, I think, 2010, the period of 2009-2010, doesn't always work elsewhere. They tried to put Jay at 10 o'clock, and the same kind of comedy just didn't work. Why do you think that is?
You know, in looking back at that you know, that was a bad decision by NBC for so many reasons.
Yeah.
And I think we came in, I think that primetime comedy, people are not, you know, I think they're just not looking for it at 10 o'clock or at 9 o'clock. I think they're looking for more situational comedy. They're looking for more of their drama. And I think that people are kind of ingrained. They just, you know, we're used to seeing it at 11 or 11:35, or, you know, if you're in the one time zone at 10:35, we're used to it then. Mm-hmm. You've seen the local news. We're done for the day. Let's get our take on the news. So if you throw that in, and the fact that they really wouldn't let NBC pretty much wanted to have us do the same show yet different.
Mm-hmm.
So you people who were expecting to see Jay did what he did with the Tonight Show were disappointed. People who wanted to see something different than getting the monologue at night were seeing something they didn't like. When people were saying, no, we'll just watch it 11:35. And I just think we were put in a situation where we weren't going to succeed. Here's the good news. It worked out for everybody in the end. You know, everyone's got a show. You know, now Jay's, you know, he's done. He's off doing stand-up, which he loves. And Jimmy mm-hmm. Fallon's doing a fantastic job.
Yeah, Jimmy is really bringing this viral aspect of it into it, where he'll do something, and then the next day it's trending on Facebook because they've put it up on YouTube. So mm-hmm. I really love to see what Jimmy is doing with it, because, like I said, I've been obsessed with late night since I can remember.
Yeah, Jimmy has kind of redefined what late night is. I mean, if you're looking for a political monologue that Jay gave,
mm-hmm.
you know, for years, you're not going to find that in Jimmy Fallon. That's not what he does. Mm-hmm. He's going to his strength, and it's almost more of a variety and sketch show late night.
Yeah.
if you're looking for the Lenos-type monologue, and again, I've been wrong in every prediction of my life, Matt, but let me make one now. I'm going to bet that's what Colbert does when he comes on. I think it's going to be a similar show. It's going to be almost like Letterman and Leno had a baby, and that's what Colbert's show would be.
That's fantastic. That's a really great insight, and I hope you're right. I really don't want to see Colbert move away. I want him to drop the character, but I don't want to see him move away from having a take on politics, because
exactly.
That's what he's so known for.
And I think you're going to see that. And again, by the way, I've been wrong in every prediction I've ever made about television my entire life. So we'll mark this down. We'll come back after Colbert comes on. You'll get me back on.
Yeah.
And I'll say, see, I was wrong again.
Yeah. The question that poses is, are your sort of stalwart classic 1135 network television hosts moving away from, I'm sorry to our listeners, this is really getting into it, but moving away from politics, the humor of politics, because you have those options on Comedy Central, you have options to find very specified political humor.
You know, I think it's just people go with their strength. When you have Leno, who's, one of the legendary stand-ups and a great monologuist, mm-hmm. That's what he's going to do. I think people just naturally gravitate towards their strengths. So I don't think anyone has that, well, we must move away from that. Mm-hmm. I think people are saying, what am I best at? And what, and will that appeal to the audience? I mean, and Fallon is absolutely, it's what he does is in his wheelhouse, and it has great appeal.
That's great.
By the way, I can't tell you what Stephen Colbert is really like.
Yeah. Nobody can.
nobody can, and, I'm sure Mrs. Colbert can. But other than that, I have no idea other than my prediction, which will be proven wrong. But I would love to see him do that.
Yeah, I would too. Now, we've been talking about late night, but you have written for so much else, so much cool stuff. The Academy Awards, Emmy Awards, Golden Globes. What, there again, the same question, although not person to person, person to event, the difference between those things?
Here's the main difference, and that's this, that a late night show needs to be topical.
Mm-hmm.
A special event show needs to be about that event. So let's take the Oscars. The hosts who have done the best, the Steve Martins, obviously, the Billy Crystal, I think, the greatest Oscar host ever, the Chris Rocks,
mm-hmm.
People like that, the Hugh Jackman, although Hugh's not a joke teller, obviously, but he's very funny and he's a five-tool entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
Could do it all. But they make it about the event. It's about the movies. It's the Emmys. It should be about TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
The, Golden Globes, again, is about movies and TV.
Yeah.
When it's those hosts do not work out well, it's when they either try to make it topical. Again, you can put in a topical joke, but make it about, it's the punchline to something about the movies.
Yeah.
Or they forget that it's about the audience that is the Oscar audience in that audience, and they try to do their own type of show.
Yeah.
I think that's what Neil Patrick Harris's problem was. He was a fantastic entertainer. When he does the Tonys, he makes it about the Tonys. This time, you're doing a magic trick. What does that have to do with the movies?
Right.
What does that have to do? And so, yes, it's something he loves and he's great at, but it's not what people want to see. They, this is a year, this is about the movie industry, the celebrities there, and the movies themselves.
Yeah, that's, I love it. Now, before we get our last question, a game I always like to play with guests, best, worst, and biggest. We're going to talk about the best laugh you ever got. I know in the book you say people try to go, oh, what's the favorite joke you've ever written? I don't want to do that. Is there a laugh that sticks out to you as the best or the biggest laugh that you've ever gotten on any of the platforms that you've written?
First of all, let's just say I am, because of a comedy writer, I'm much more likely to remember the 17,000 non-laughs when there was nothing but dead silence. But probably the two biggest laughs, two of the biggest laughs I remember, let's go to the Oscars for a second, and one was with Steve Martin. It was in 2003, and Michael Moore, Steve was hosting the Oscars. Michael Moore was winning a bunch of awards, the Writers Guild Award, the Directors Guild Award, this award. And we knew that at every show he would come out there and he would rip into President Bush. So we said, if he's going to win Best Documentary, let's be prepared. So he came out there and he launched into this two-minute speech, ripping President Bush, ripping the war in Iraq. You know, it's an unconscionable war, President Bush. You're wrong, and ripping him. And it was so, even though Hollywood was obviously a little bit of a liberal and left-wing place, it was so over the top. People started to boo, and you got a lot of noise, and people upset. You could just tell, and it got nothing.
Yeah.
So Steve went out there, and right afterwards, and we wrote that right backstage with Steve, and he went out there and goes, isn't that great? The Teamsters are helping Michael Moore to the trunk of his limo. And the place exploded. And Steve walked back, and he just looked at us and just went, wow. The other moment, and I wish so much I had been part of this, but I wasn't. This was a Billy Crystal ad lib. This was in like 1991, 1992 in the Oscars. This was probably the biggest laugh I've ever seen. Was the, you know, he pointed out Hal Roach in the audience. Now, again, no one who's listening to you, Matt, knows who Hal Roach is. He was a great silent film director, and he was 102 years old. And he stood up in the audience, if you really acknowledge him, which he shouldn't have been. It was just more of a shout out. Mm-hmm. And he started to talk, and he wouldn't sit down. Well, of course, he wasn't mic'd. So he was talking for about 30 seconds. It's embarrassing. He's talking. No one can hear him. And then Billy just said, well, we can see why you started in silent film. And just the place went nuts.
That's brilliant.
So, I mean, those are probably the biggest. The non-laughs?
Yeah.
I mean, there's just too many, and it's too painful and traumatic.
I won't go there then with you. That's certainly. Now, I know my listeners, and they will kill me. They will absolutely kill me if I do not end with this question. We talked a lot about the examples of finding these things, and you can see in the book a lot of the jokes that you've written. You've put them down from all the hosts and all late night and a lot of your stuff. But in your opinion, boil it down. What makes a killer joke?
What makes a killer joke is the following, to me. Succinctly, I hope I pronounced that right, stated the premise. It has to be about a topic we are interested in, or that when we hear it, we become interested in. It has to have a twist. It has to have something that the normal person wouldn't have thought about. But the minute then they do, mm-hmm. they instantly take the side of what the comic is about to deliver. And then the punchline, which is either unexpected or taking it to an exaggerated level. You know, I hate to dissect humor, mm-hmm. but to me, you know, the jokes that do the best, you know, work that way. If I had to make it completely simple, if I had to boil it down, surprise. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, something that comes out completely as a surprise. So, you know, when you see Steve Martin come out there, he's coming out, you just expect he's going to introduce the next act. But when he says that, obviously he's showing he's in charge. It's more of, you know, it's an ad-lib thrown out. I mean, it's a written ad-lib in one sense. Mm-hmm. But it was a surprise. No one expected it, so that really worked. If you add that element in, you've got a classic joke.
That is awesome. All right, John Max, you have a classic book on your hands. I cannot wait to see big, big things for this book. You're also the author of four more books?
Yeah, there's a number of other books. That, you know, they're, as I call them, the other ones are all fine, fine pieces of literature, but I'm sorry, some trees died for them. They're more what I call just, you know, they're parody books, whatever. This is one of them. I like them all, but this is one that I think really, you know, monologue, you know, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed, really, I think, tells a story that I think is, I hope, fun and interesting and a little entertaining for anyone who reads it.
I know it will be. I know my listeners, and I knew as soon as I read it, I had to have you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Appreciate it. Take care, man. Thank you so much.
John, it was awesome talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. To purchase Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed, head over to Amazon.com or visit your favorite bookstore. And that's it for us this week, and that's it for us this season on Ventriloquism Weekly. But don't you fret, we will be back in June in a big way. This is what I was talking about last week. I was going to explain to you why we were coming back when we are. We will be coming to you live on tape from a location we haven't been to yet. So stay tuned for more information on that in the coming days. That's right. I can tell you that because of our on-location premiere, we will be returning June 22nd. Now, that's a little later in the month, but still only about a month away, if you can believe it. Month, 5 weeks, how much time flies. Until then, thank you so much for listening. A reminder, you can find all you need to know about Ventriloquism Weekly by going to our website, ventriloquismweekly.com. Reach out by emailing ventriloquismweekly@gmail.com and find our group on Facebook at facebook.com/TALKFORTWO. Tweet at us and hashtag about us @#TalkForTwo. From New York, signing off and thanking you so much for a great season of a lot of fun, great guests, and great listener interaction. I can't wait to come back next month. Signing off for Ventriloquism Weekly from New York, I'm Matt Bailey, reminding all you vents out there to keep talking for two. I will see you in June.